Welcome to Left, Right, and Center. I'm McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, and your host this week, filling in for David Green. The U.S. is set to give tens of billions of dollars in new aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. President Biden signed a $95 billion foreign aid package. This was a major priority for the president, and the package had overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress. But getting it passed was a hard-fought battle in the House and the Senate, and it could yet topple House Speaker Mike Johnson. Johnson worked with Democrats to pass the bill because the far-right faction of his conference opposed the Ukraine funding in particular. And in the Senate, outgoing Minority Leader Mitch McConnell successfully rallied a majority of Republican support, something he was unable to do when this funding was previously up for a vote. McConnell sounded straight up victorious over the right flank of his party when he talked to reporters this week.
I think we've turned the corner on the isolationist movement. I've noticed how uncomfortable proponents of that are when you call them isolationists. So I think we've made some progress, and I think it's going to have to continue because we got big problems.
We've got our regular left, right, and center panel here to discuss this divide on foreign aid and where it leaves the party. We have Mo Alethi, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. He was also communications director for the Democratic National Committee and an advisor to Hillary Clinton. And Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch. She is a lawyer and was the spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Hi, guys.
Hey, McKay.
Welcome, McKay.
I'm excited to be here with you.
Should be.
Well, it is a thrill. I just ask that you both go easy on me. Sarah, I want to start with you. We just heard those comments from Mitch McConnell, a bit of triumphalism from the minority leader. Does this episode really silence what he refers to as the isolationists in the GOP?
No, because what drives the so-called isolationists within the GOP is not really the policy issue. It is, in fact, being orthogonal to Mitch McConnell.
Right.
So the isolationism was a helpful way to be on the other side of Mitch McConnell. But trust me, they'll find plenty of other issues. And we saw this recently. Eric Erickson, a well-known conservative commentator, wrote a piece in the National Review about conservatives standing up for free markets, like the most boring stuff you could have ever imagined if it had been between 1980 and let's call it 2015. But the chief of staff at the Heritage Foundation basically said, we no longer really do free markets anymore. If you don't mind, I'll just read. He said, this piece sadly defines the problem with establishment conservatism. Free markets and limited government are not ends in themselves, but rather means to an end, that is, justly ordered society full of human flourishing. The conservative movement must stop defending free markets, though it is a good, and start defending the American family for which the free market was created to serve. Hmm. That's the same group of people who are the isolationists. It's the same group of people who, have been anti-free speech in certain contexts. Basically, they've found themselves as right-wing progressives, by which I'm mostly referring to like the old school progressive movement of the turn of the last century, this idea that we know how society should be ordered. And if you will just give us all of the tools in government with our experts, we will order society in the correct, in the good way, the common good, whatever that is. Progressives, meaning even today's progressives, also still believe that. And so now we're just having a fight over whose definition of good you want to pursue instead of what conservatism under Reagan, et cetera, was actually standing for, which is that the process is what would create the most good for the most number of people, whether it's free markets, limited government, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sort of that Burkean minimalism, if you will. So look, Mitch McConnell is the old school Reagan three-legged stool guy. These new folks, for a variety of reasons that we can get into, want to tear that down. Therefore, there will always be a reason to tear it down. They lost the Ukraine fight, but they're not losing the bigger fight to remake the right, the Republican Party, from conservative into whatever this new thing is.
Mo, can I just ask you, do you agree that this is ultimately about just kind of a new manifestation of anti-establishment politics, or is there something deeper going on here ideologically?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, there has typically been the rift between within, I think, the right between isolationists and people who are more interested in a robust involvement in foreign affairs. That's not new, right? We've seen that battle before. And it has ebbed and flowed, though I think the strong, maybe not interventionist, but at least involved strain of the Republican Party has typically won those battles. So the fight over whether or not how much the United States should engage in the rest of the world, that's not a new one. I think it is Pollyannish to believe what Mitch McConnell said, which is this puts it to bed. It doesn't. It might put it to bed for the moment, but it's going to come back. And if you want evidence of that, it is the fact that a majority of the Republicans in the House voted against this. They voted against the aid package. Mm-hmm. That is actually the dominant position within the Republican Party right now. Now, I would also argue, I don't think that was for purely ideological reasons. I don't think there are that many isolationists in the Republican caucus. I think that was because Defendant Trump asked them to vote no on this, right? Trump is pushing this perspective, and he's got a hardcore group willing to go along with him. And so if we want to know who's going to win out this ultimate battle, right, we may not know unless, you know, if Donald Trump gets elected, will you see this level of foreign aid continue? Mm-hmm. Or will you see a massive retreat cutting off our allies, particularly in Ukraine, very early in his next term?
You know, I have been doing some reporting in Europe recently, and I can tell you that American allies in that region of the world where Russian aggression is very much not an abstract matter had been following this Ukraine aid package fight very closely, to the point where, people I was talking to in Poland or Germany, you know, were boning up on like committee structures and the internal caucus fights in the House. And
we would like to apologize to all people trying to learn how our Congress works.
It's very complicated.
Including Americans.
Yeah, I was going to say. But I guess my question is, what message do you think it sends to U.S. allies that this was such a slog to get it passed? Or is the only thing that matters that it ultimately got done in the end?
Okay, so good and bad news, right? The bad news is that it took as much political lift as it did because of all the reasons we talked about, or just because of negative polarization. It actually benefits mm-hmm. both sides to be against whatever the other side comes out in favor of. And we've seen that on endless policy issues that are hilarious when one side used to be for something, but now the other side's for it. So now our side has to be against it, et cetera. That's happened on both sides repeatedly now in this realignment process. So that's the bad news. As the two parties realign, you're going to see more stuff like this, and our allies get caught in the middle of some of these fights. The good news, though, I think, is a little bit hidden here, but Mike Johnson was not one of the people who on paper should have been for Ukraine funding and aid at all. But when it looks like you sit someone down, give them all the briefings, and put the heavy crown on their head that this decision will lie with them, whether Ukraine falls. And really, it's more like Ukraine will definitely fall if we don't do this. They might fall if we do it. Do you want to be the one responsible for it definitely falling?
Right.
He changed his mind. And I think that's very good news for our allies, that for all the blustering and partisan bickering, that when the decision is actually yours, that our leaders still look like they're willing to make the rational decision for American interests.
Mo, it's interesting because a lot of people doubted Mike Johnson, right? And they're taking a second look at him. I'll just read one headline from The Atlantic, the magazine where I write. It asked, "What if Mike Johnson is actually good at this?" Which I think is a sentiment you're seeing from a lot of people right now. So I'm curious, did Johnson skeptics underestimate him? Is it worth kind of reconsidering our initial thoughts on him?
Look, he deserves a lot of credit for this. And I think a lot of Democrats actually do give him credit for this. We'll see what the next act is, right? And does he feel like he spends so much political capital within his own caucus on this that he's now got to go in the other direction? So it's too soon to say whether or not people were right or wrong in the long term. But in this case, he deserves a lot of credit. So does President Biden. This was a case where old school legislative master Joe Biden read the room right, and he read his audience right, his audience of one, Speaker Johnson. And the reporting was that it was Biden who said, give this guy every single briefing we could possibly give him. He's the one who directed his team, lay off of the speaker. Let's not launch any political broadsides against him. And the two sides came together. And I mean, the way Washington used to work on big issues like this, the way it should work on big issues like this, it worked on this big issue. And I think both sides deserve a lot of credit for that. On your previous question, though, to Sarah about what message does it send to our allies, I think you heard a collective sigh of relief, but not of any sense that the U.S. is back, right? I think there is still a lot of consternation out there, a lot of concern. They saw how difficult it was. They saw that a majority of the Republican Party is still against this. They're all keeping an eye on November. If the election flips the White House and the House, and the Senate, I think there is very, very real concern amongst our allies about whether or not we can be depended on in the face of Russian aggression, especially under its second Trump administration. That hasn't gone away. It was a short-term reprieve, but not anything more than that.
Just turning very briefly to the Israel part of this aid package, we haven't heard much from Republicans about whether the long-term goal of Israel's war in Gaza is realistic. But we're now 200 days into the war, and while Hamas has been weakened, it hasn't been eliminated. Could this situation reach a point where the conflict grinds on long enough and enough civilian casualties are tallied that the tide of support in the GOP begins to turn against this as well, or is that out of the question?
I think that's largely out of the question because of domestic political reasons. What's so interesting about this conflict is I think it's captured our domestic political conversation more than any other that I can think of in my lifetime. And because of that, as I said of the previous stuff, right, everyone's moved into their camps. So as long as faculty at Columbia is blocking Jews from walking through the quad, yeah, the GOP is going to be firmly on the side of Israel, not because they're following the details of what's happening in Israel or they have some firm, strategic goal for how the war ends, but because of the domestic political side of it. They're on that side, so I'm on this side. And I think the reverse is also very true. It's fracturing the Democratic Party. And so Democrats, sort of establishment Democrats, elected Democrats, however you want to think about them, they want this conversation to move on as quickly as possible. Republicans, therefore, do not. So they also want it to stay a domestic political issue, which these college students are helping every single day.
Well, some college students and a lot of outside agitators. But yeah, I don't disagree with the overarching sentiment. But I think it's also driven not just by domestic politics in the U.S., but by domestic politics in Israel as well. And I think if and when there is a new election in Israel, which Benjamin Netanyahu is going to resist for as long as he possibly can, depending on the outcome of that election, which most people, including in Israel, believes would see a new government take over, I'll be curious to see how that impacts the politics around this here. If the hard right loses control in Israel and the left or center left takes over, will you still see the same full-throated defense that you see from Republicans? Will you see some progressives start to want to re-engage with Israel in ways that we seem to not right now? So I do think that the domestic politics, both in the U.S. and in Israel, are playing a part in this. Whether or not people are just they get to the point of sheer and total exhaustion with this that it changes it. It's hard for me to see people getting more exhausted than they are right now, right? I mean, this has been going on for so long, and we are seeing so many deaths. I don't think there are a lot of people out there that want to see the continuation of the conflict. I just don't think there's any sense, even within the Democratic Party, on the best way to get to the end.
We'll leave it there. I'll be back with Mo Alethi and Sarah Isger to talk about the latest news surrounding the third party vote in 2024. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Support comes from BetterHelp. Our negative thoughts can stick with us, so we all have something to get off our chest. Therapy is a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down, so you can get some relief and find a solution. BetterHelp offers professional, affordable, online therapy on a flexible schedule. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/LRC today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/LRC.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic, filling in for your host, David Green. We're joined by Mo Alethi, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service, and Sarah Isger, lawyer, senior editor at The Dispatch, and former spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s presidential campaign has been dismissed by Democrats as an attempt to spoil President Biden's run for re-election. That's because most polling has suggested Kennedy's campaign is more harmful to Biden. However, new polling from NBC News revealed that RFK's independent run might actually be siphoning more support from Donald Trump than Biden. NBC reported that while Trump maintains a slight advantage over Biden in a head-to-head matchup, his numbers took a hit when the field was widened to include Kennedy and fellow third-party candidates Jill Stein and Cornel West. Their polling shows that Kennedy was much more favorable in the eyes of Republican voters and that 15% of Trump respondents in a head-to-head matchup switched their vote to Kennedy, whereas only 7% of Biden respondents made the switch. The pollsters conducting the survey for NBC said it could be an outlier or a sign of things to come. So, Mo, is this cause for celebration in the Biden camp?
I wouldn't say cause for celebration, but I think the answer about whether or not this is an outlier has come just in the last couple of days. Since that NBC News poll came out, there have been two other respected national polls that are showing the same exact trend line, both from Marist and from Quinnipiac, all showing Biden v. Trump narrowing, and that with RFK in the mix, he's drawing more votes from Trump than he is from Biden. I don't put a lot of stock in polls beyond the trend lines that they show. And if we are starting to see a trend line, that is going to change the dynamics of the race quite a bit. And you also are seeing it not just in the polls, but in the way the campaigns are dealing with this. Months ago, the Democratic National Committee hired one of the most brass knuckle operatives in the party, Liz Smith, to run their rapid response operation against third parties, i.e. RFK. This was at the same time that conservative media was just talking up RFK left and right. In the past month or so, you were seeing a very real change in how RFK is getting covered on outlets like Fox, Newsmax, some of the others. They're starting to come after him a little bit more. And you're even seeing some Trump folks, Trump surrogates going after him a little bit more. So clearly, the Republicans in the Trump campaign are beginning to sense that for all their work to try to help get him on the ballot in some states early on, they might have something to worry about, too.
You know, anecdotally, the RFK curious people I know are not Biden voters. They're in that category that's been described as double haters, or they're right-leaning people who are suffering from some kind of Trump fatigue, right? And I'm curious, Sarah, do you think it's possible that the conventional wisdom about this has been all wrong and that actual Biden voters could be more loyal to their candidate than Trump voters?
No, I think Biden voters will take any off-ramp they can find, asterisk, except RFK. I think RFK has managed to create this niche that really, for any host of reasons, is going to appeal so much more to MAGA Republicans. Not all Republicans, and not really that many Democrats. I think the Democrats that it's going to appeal to were those low propensity voter sort of fringe folks who always hated the Democratic Party. That's very in vogue now to also hate the two parties, regardless of which candidate you're voting for. But these are sort of the general people who've always hated the Democratic Party, don't think that it's progressive enough, it's too establishment, sort of the fringes even of the Bernie movement. I think those people are still going to be attracted to an RFK type, but that's where the horseshoe theory of politics really comes in. Those people are the MAGA people. Like, as the two parties align, a lot of those people have moved right on over into Trump's camp. That's why I think you're seeing it take more from Trump in some of these polls. Now, like Mo, not only do we sort of not take the polls qua the numbers in the polls, we look at the trend lines. Also, those trend lines can change quite a bit over the coming months because those people are low propensity voters generally. They're pretty low information voters. Things can change them pretty easily too, whether they're going to vote at all. They learn something random about one of the two candidates that we've known or that's really baked into us. They might not know that thing. I think you'll be shocked by how many people have no idea that Donald Trump is in the middle of a criminal trial, what he's on trial for, things he has said. So I think we overestimate the amount of information that has penetrated usual voters, high propensity voters. These RFK voters are incredibly unstable voters, in my view, because they're low propensity, low information voters by and large.
And that's why I think you're going to see both campaigns, but I think
freak
you're
going
to see both campaigns freak out and be aggressive, right? That's why the DNC hired Liz Smith. That's why, you know, look, everyone thought the Kennedy campaign was brilliant when they bought that 60-second ad during the Super Bowl that was just a knockoff on an old John Kennedy ad, right? Because they just thought that was a way for him to reach some of those low propensity, low information voters who might just feel nostalgia and connect the dots between the Kennedy, the various generations of Kennedy. But what did the Biden campaign do recently? They did a big event with the entire rest of the Kennedy family and cut that into an ad to push back in order to sort of say to people, like, this ain't your daddy or granddaddy's Kennedy. I also think, you know, to your point, Sarah, about Democrats looking for an off-ramp, and it's not going to be RFK, 100% it's not going to be RFK. As more and more people get information about Kennedy and they find out that he's an anti-vaxxer and a conspiracy theorist, that's not going to appeal to anyone that's looking for an off-ramp from Joe Biden. May appeal to some MAGA people. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't think most Democrats are going to find an off-ramp. They don't see they don't see anything else that is going to prevent Donald Trump from being president, and that is their number one priority. There is no off-ramp from Joe Biden if you want to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. And so that's why I don't think you're going to see as much bleed on the Democratic
side. Yeah, and to clarify,
side.
Democrats want an off-ramp more than Republicans do. Just based on the polling, more Republicans are happy with their candidate than Democrats are happy with their candidate. But Mo's 100% right. There's no off-ramp coming. And when I talk about voters not knowing as much as, you know, we sort of assume they do, or people who listen to this podcast, I mean, I was stunned up until the very end. People still asking me, what's Nikki Haley's path to victory? What? There's no off-ramp coming. And that is only going to start setting in for people in these next few months. It hasn't already set in. It will bake. They will come home. We are just starting to see that in the polls. It's why I think the polls have shifted from Trump up in every single swing state and all the national polling, then it kind of settled in a little bit. And I think the main reason for that is people realizing on the left who really wanted that off-ramp, there's no off-ramp. And so Mo's right. They've started to come home. The national polling's tied up. Trump's still ahead in almost all of the swing states, but not by as much. Those numbers are going to continue, I think, to move in that general direction where both sides realize there's no help coming.
You're listening to Left, Right, and Center from KCRW. We're talking about Robert F. Kennedy's impact on this election with Mo Alethi and Sarah Isger. Kennedy has gotten on the ballot in Michigan by aligning with an obscure party that already had access. His a super PAC backing him says that they have enough signatures for several more states, including Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Arizona, Georgia. He says he wants to get on the ballot in all 50 states, has a plan to do so. How seriously really should we be taking him as a factor come November? I mean, do you expect that he will be a spoiler in one or more battleground states?
Could be.
I mean, ask Al Gore how seriously we should take Ralph Nader, right? Ask Hillary Clinton how seriously we should have taken Jill Stein in 2016. If this race is as close as I think any rational political observer on either side of the aisle would agree it is, we're talking margins. We are talking even a candidate who wins an electoral college landslide will do so in a bunch of 51-49 races, or more likely 47-46% races with a couple of points here and there going to other candidates. We just are – it's unclear right now. Again, who's going to get hit the hardest by all of this?
We call certain things swing states, and we're going to talk about that in a second. We don't know which states this is going to come down to. So that's why the ballot access really matters. He's on the ballot in Michigan. There's a great chance that Michigan's a swing state. There's also a great chance that it's not. Not close enough where it's going to make much of a difference. But I'm reminded of something that someone from Hillary Clinton's team said that is just, I think it was Mandy Grunwald, Mo, from 2016, that has just stuck with me because it's so true. And she put it so well. You know, some reporter was asking, is this the reason that you lost? And then he was like, well, what about this other reason that you lost and this other reason? She's like, every single reason that you can come up with is the reason that we lost. Because in a close election, if you can name 50 things, any one of those 50 things going the other way would have won us this election. So yes, we lost 100%. For 50,000 reasons. So whoever wins this election or loses this election, when we look back and say, was RFK a meaningful part of this or a reason? If it's a close election, as Mo said, the answer is going to be yes. But I guess the real question we should be asking is, was it the but-for cause? Was there a bigger reason? Was there a more trend line reason that wasn't just, you know, that anyone could have done what RFK did? Any third party getting attention would have done the same thing as RFK, because that's less interesting than that it is RFK and his specific message, or that these two candidates are so unpopular that they drive people to a third party. Because otherwise, anyone else who's on the ballot who gets 10 votes matters if it's a 9-vote margin.
Well, so this is my question. Is there anything that the Biden campaign or the Trump campaign can or should be doing to target those RFK voters? You mentioned just, attack, basically getting a hard scrabble operative to go after him in rapid response. But is there any element of his profile, his message, his campaign that, one of the two campaigns could try to grasp onto to take some of his supporters?
Well, I think Mo highlighted exactly what the strategy of both campaigns will be, because it's what Chuck Schumer has done so effectively when they've put money into Republican campaigns. They run attack ads in quotation marks, when actually the attack ads are advocacy ads for their other side's people. So every time you run an ad from the left that's like, RFK is super MAGA conservative, sure, it's an attack ad against RFK, but what they're actually doing, the purpose, is to try to get those voters, like Mo said, who would otherwise be sort of fringy Trump voters, to be like, well, maybe I'll vote for RFK instead. Expect the Trump campaign to do the exact same thing. RFK loves abortion. Well, yeah, it's an attack ad, but it's really aimed at those fringe Democratic voters who might vote for Biden, might stay home, who knows, getting them to be like, oh, really? He's so super for abortion? Huh, okay, I'll take a look.
Right, environmental extremist, RFK, yes. right?
Good one, like, yeah. Yeah. Oh, we could do you'll this see. All day. Grifter yeah. Mo and Grifter yeah. Sarah you'll are see ready some of that. For the game, okay?
I think what the Biden campaign ought to do more than do that is run more ads, as they just started to do this week, targeting disaffected Nikki Haley voters. If they want to have an actual impact, I think there is more likelihood that they will get some traction there than they would with whatever they do about RFK.
Why haven't they called Chris Christie?
That's a great question.
Why haven't they been really courting Chris Christie, courting Nikki Haley, to try to actually get them on board, saying, you know what, I'm going to announce right now that Chris Christie is my attorney general, or pick something else, fine. But like, the point being, make it a real courting.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't know whether or not we know Chris Christie has come out and said they're not calling him. And in true Chris Christie fashion, asked the question the way you did. He's like, I don't know why they're not calling me. They ought to be.
I love Chris.
And I don't know what sort of outreach may or may not have been done to Nikki Haley, but you are starting to see much more aggressive outreach to her voters in a way that you absolutely are not from the Trump campaign, right? The Trump campaign is still saying, well, if those Haley voters, they know where we are, they can come find us. The Biden campaign just this week started running ads in swing states, talking directly to them. That's going to be, I think, a much more pivotal group than RFK.
I hope our listeners appreciate the 3D chess from two veteran political strategists that they have been able to consume here. This is why you guys have had careers in politics, and I am but a lowly political reporter.
I was going to say, that also could explain why neither one of us is currently employed in politics.
Let's leave it there. I've been talking with Sarah Isger and Mo Alethi. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, McKay Coppins. We're here with Sarah Isger, senior editor at The Dispatch, and we're joined by Mo Alethi, executive director at Georgetown University's Institute of Politics and Public Service. As we discuss all the moving parts that'll play into a tight election this year, I want to focus on swing states. There are six states considered truly competitive, Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Another state, North Carolina, is expected to lean toward Trump. Conventional wisdom says that we can look to past political performance in these states to determine the likely results. Sarah, your colleague at The Dispatch, Chris Steierwalt, writes that although everything else about this rematch of the 2020 election is different, the states remain the same. He wrote, all the states have their own traits in local politics. Down ballot races will have their effects, all true. But for now, it's helpful to remember that there's still an order to things. So does that change our idea of the traditional swing state coming into the election? Mo, when you look at the battleground where this election will be won or lost, it looks pretty familiar, right? The margins in some of these states were slim in 2020, but Biden did end up winning a handy majority of electoral votes. Is there reason to think this will be different this year? Or is this good news for him that the map basically looks the same?
I mean, different-ish. I mean, so a couple of things, right? I mean, I remember when I worked on my first presidential campaign back in 2000, there were 17 swing states. right? 17 states that were considered battleground states. Wow. Now we're talking six that you maybe stretch to eight, right? I think the six you identified, add in North Carolina, and I would also add in New Hampshire, right? Those are mm-hmm. probably the eight states that will determine this campaign. And the fundamental dynamic in all of them is that they were close in the last couple of elections. They will be close again this time. I don't think you can fully identify which way it's going to go. I don't think you can look at the map and from 2020 and say it is predictive. I think that was a mistake that previous presidential campaigns have made. I think that was part of the mistake the Trump campaign made in 2020. I think that was part of the mistake the Clinton campaign made in 2016, was they based some assumptions off of previous models. And as we have seen in the last couple of presidential elections, the model keeps changing. Who turns out to vote keeps changing. Who is the most mobilized out of loyalty to a party keeps changing. Those who are most mobilized by antipathy towards the other party keeps changing. And I think that much is going to remain constant. I think you're going to continue to see these be battlegrounds, and I think you're going to continue to see them be battlegrounds, not just in these same states, but in the same counties within those states. And that's where this is going to be won and lost. In some places, we are seeing some sign for concern for President Biden, right? Nevada is a state that just right now feels a little bit more tenuous than it did 4 years ago. And I think that's in part, Sarah mentioned earlier, a realignment that's going on. We're seeing some of that. We're seeing a realignment there. We're seeing a realignment within some working class voters and Latinos. That could make that state a little bit more complicated. We are seeing North Carolina be maybe more competitive this time than it was last time, which would fly against the conventional wisdom. And again, I think some of this realignment that we're talking about, we are still seeing Republicans truly, truly struggling with suburban women. And increasingly, that is changing some of these states. I think there's one state that is going to be the most fascinating to watch, although I put North Carolina higher up on my list of states to watch than most people do, and that's Arizona. Arizona, my home state, you are seeing a complete and total collision of almost every force, every factor anyone is talking about in this race are all colliding with one another in Arizona, from the issue set, immigration versus abortion, right, to changing demographics of a state, to how the Trump legal issues are playing, right? Just this week we saw six people from Trump orbit get indicted for the fake elector scheme there. So I just think there's a lot happening. That will be the most interesting state. But I think this realignment everywhere is going to shift in the margins within some key counties in a way that's going to be impactful.
Sarah, are there any states that you're especially interested in terms of where this realignment might manifest in interesting ways?
Yes. So first, I'll disagree ever so slightly with Mo because it's fun, which is I don't think that the swing states are the same as last time. Or I guess I'm disagreeing with Chris Steyerwalt, my colleague, because swing states aren't defined as the same states that were seen as competitive after we got the results are now seen as competitive before we get the results. You have to look at which states we thought were competitive before we got the results. What were the swing states we thought were swing states in the run up to the election? Because swing states are like tectonic plates. They move slowly and they tend to move in a single direction over time. So, in my lifetime, Texas, California, those have all been swing states, all heading in one direction over time, and they just kept heading in that direction, which is why Texas is now considered a deep red state, California is considered a deep blue state. But then there's moments where there's the tectonic plates sort of hit each other, and there's sort of this sudden shift, earthquake. That's Georgia in 2020, no question about it. But Florida, Ohio, we were still watching those. We were still considering those swing states in 2020. Now we pretend like we didn't think they were, because those states continue to move in the direction they had been moving for the last 10, 15 years, 20 years, really. And so we're not even putting Florida and Ohio on our list for the first time in 25 years. So I think that's worth noting. Two swing states have totally gone off the map. We don't even talk about them anymore. In the meantime, we've got several that are coming online, as Mo's mentioned. North Carolina has been trending this way, and it kind of flips back and forth, and then it kind of slips off the map. Virginia was doing the same thing for a while, and then it finally kind of moved off of our swing state list. Arizona and Georgia are fascinating to me for the same reason. Georgia, because it was that earthquake of a swing state, it had never been on anyone's list beforehand. And now it's like, oh yeah, obviously Georgia, a swing state. What? In 2016, we did not even mention Georgia as a possible swing state. And then the Midwestern block, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, which all, you know, Pennsylvania was always considered, I guess, kind of a swing state, maybe Wisconsin, but Michigan was considered pretty long gone, you know, in 2012 for Republicans. Then they all come back on the map, and not just as swing states, in the Republican column in 2016. And then they all swing back to the Democratic column in 2020. I think that's, for me, where the realignment is really happening, because that's where you have these blue-collar, non-college-educated voters in their sort of most concentrated form. And they're moving over to the Republican Party. And then in 2020, we can do a whole podcast on what happened in 2020, but right, they don't show up, or they switch back over to Biden. Some of them are moving back over to Trump. More of them are going to show up this time. Like, that to me is where I look at the party realignment more. But obviously, for just political fun, yeah, I watch Arizona and Georgia because that's fun.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, the way we talk about which states are battleground states or swing states and which ones aren't, it is strange. You know, Florida, you mentioned, Trump only won that state by 3 points, but nobody's talking about it as a battleground state in 2024. It's a strange phenomenon. I will ask you both. Well, is there any kind of dark horse battleground state that's not on that list that I read that could be become interesting later in the race? I mean, I guess, Mo, you mentioned New Hampshire. I think that's,
I swear to God, if Mo says Texas, I'm going to throw something at him.
I have never said Texas. In fact, I was one of those few Democrats that when everyone was talking about flipping Texas, I was like, you know, we should really look at North Carolina and Georgia first. And, you know, that's what we're seeing, is that those have become much more
competitive. And they were like, no, let's spend $90 million in Kentucky.
I'll tell you what a sleeper is for me. I'm wondering if there's a chance Florida comes back online. Mm. I mean, you're right. I mean, Florida has never been a huge blowout, though I think Donald Trump won that state more comfortably than most people typically do. Then we saw Ron DeSantis win it, the governor's race, in a blowout at a time when, you know, Florida, when was the last time a Florida governor's race was won in a blowout? Usually that's always won by, you know, whichever party by no more than 2 points.
That was probably what changed the narrative, right, people, about Florida, right? The
right,
DeSantis
and people
win.
Did start
19-point, yeah. DeSantis win.
But you're seeing an energy amongst Democrats on the ground there that really was sort of awoken by all of the Ron DeSantis stuff that's going on the ground, and the book bans, and then the abortion ban that recently passed. I think there are some people that think Florida might be in play, and at the very least, the Trump campaign might have to spend resources to defend it, if nothing else. And those are resources that aren't going into other states. So that's a place I think is worth looking at. And then I always think it's worth looking at the two freakishly flukes of electoral votes, in the single one in Maine and the single one in Nebraska, that because of those state laws, those are the two states that are not winner take all with the Electoral College. You see the one in Nebraska, the singular one in Omaha, becoming more blue, and you see the singular vote in Maine becoming more red. That to me is going to be interesting.
Sarah, do you have a dark horse swing state?
No, because Nevada's already on the map as a swing state. But the last time Republicans won Nevada was 2004. And really, Nevada is one of those weird swing states where it had been pretty heavily in the Republican camp. Bill Clinton won it. Then George W. Bush won it. Then Barack Obama won it. Really, Donald Trump in 2016 is the only recent president to lose Nevada and nevertheless win the presidency. Nevada's interesting because if it moves back as a real swing state, it will be because of the Latino vote in the state becoming more diverse, less solidly Democrat. We're seeing it in the numbers, and we're seeing it sort of dramatically in poll numbers. I want to see the rubber hit the road on that one, because that will be online as a swing state for very different reasons, I think, than it's been in the past.
Look, there's a reason, and longtime listeners know that I was involved in the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee, which shook up our primary calendar. There is a reason why you heard so many people making a pitch to move Nevada further up in the primary schedule, because everyone sees it as not just diverse, but as one of the most competitive battleground states moving forward, and that they wanted to see a Democratic message come into that state even earlier in the process. So I'm with you. I think it is going to be one of the most fascinating. That and Arizona, I think, are going to be two of the most fascinating to watch.
We are going to have to leave it there. We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants and raves, featuring pet peeves and proclivities from across the political spectrum. Sarah Isger, what's on your mind?
It's the season that we all plant things, and I just would like to rant and rave about the fickleness of plants. I've had a cat for 17 plus years now, and yet plants really are hard. They don't tell you what they need. By the time they are telling you, it's usually too late. So this is a rant about plants. You're fascinating. The more books that there are written about you and the way that fungus allows you to communicate with each other through the ground and sort of the canopy puzzle pieces that you weave together, you are complicated, fascinating creatures. We respect you, but please be easier to keep alive.
I like that you slipped into the second person addressing the plants directly. I hope a lot of plants were listening there. Mo, what's on your mind?
How many of you are listening to your podcast out loud? Take out your earbuds and let your plants listen, because we also have those studies that show that they like it when we talk to them.
Okay, there you go. Mo?
I don't even know where to go with that. I am spending a lot of time on airplanes these days. I feel like I am on one or two flights every week. And I don't think it's very controversial to say airlines generally suck. Like, yes, marvels of modern technology that can get us places so quickly. God bless them for that. Lots of amazing people work for the airlines, but they don't treat their customers super well. And I've been feeling it a lot lately with lost luggage, massive delays, as most Americans have. So, middle of this week, when Secretary Buttigieg announced the administration's attempts to make the airlines more accountable by eliminating a lot of the hidden fees, requiring an automatic refund, not something I have to haggle with, but an automatic refund for cancellations or significant delays, I breathe a little bit of sigh of relief. Secretary Pete, you are singing my song this week. Let's stick it to the airlines, who too often stick it to us.
For my rave, I'm going to give a little shout out to courtroom sketch artists. If you have been following Donald Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan, you probably know there are no cameras allowed in the courtroom. This is in keeping with New York state law. It's been the source of some controversy. I don't want to get into the controversy right now. I just want to say that, the only document of this historic trial is what's being drawn by these courtroom sketch artists, which is obviously very stressful for them. Actually, there was one artist who was quoted recently saying, "I've been doing this job for some 43 years, but this was the most stressful assignment yet." I think they're doing a great job. Maybe this is partly due to my own lack of artistic ability. I have young children that like to draw with me, and I am not only worse than my 11-year-old daughter, I'm significantly worse than my 6-year-old daughter at drawing. So I'm just like marveling at these courtroom sketches. But I'll also say this. There's something quaint and, like, endearing about the archaic medium of courtroom sketches. And I think I've seen plenty of photos of Donald Trump in a suit sitting in a courtroom. I like that the historical record of this will be, in large part, these courtroom sketches. I think it'll make for a more interesting and valuable historical artifact. And so that's my rave for today. I don't aspire to ever end up in a courtroom, but I would love to be sketched by a courtroom sketch artist. So if anyone wants to volunteer for that who's listening, get in touch with me. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger and Moa Lathy. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Mark K. Green. Our executive producer is Arnie Seipel. The show is recorded by Sue Margulies and mixed by Phil Richards. Special thanks to IdeaStream Public Media for hosting me here in Cleveland today. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. Left, Right, and Center is a co-production of KCRW and Fearless Media. We are distributed by PRX. I'm McKay Coppins. Thanks for joining us. David Green will be back next week, so come back for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.